Welcome to episode one of this podcast called Rover Talk. Now, as you already heard in the intro, my name is Ivan, and with me I have Dan, who is the famed Wagon Boy TD username from Bring a Trailer with over 17,000 million likes. Considered amongst us Rover guys kind of an expert. He has a Rover problem, which he may or may not admit, but it's a privilege to be able to do this podcast with him. Today, we're talking about my personal favorite, and probably one of Dan's favorites as well, which is the Range Rover. Now, a lot of you who understand Range Rovers or understand the mark, understand Land Rover, know that this is not the first Land Rover product, and that it is a Land Rover product and not a brand on its own, although most people know it more as a Range Rover than a Land Rover Range Rover. And I wanted to get into a few different things about the Range Rover. But for starters, let's let Dan give himself a little bit of an introduction and start off with the history of the Range Rover.
Hey, this is Dan, otherwise known as Wagon Boy TD. In a few places, you know, as Ivan had stated, the Range Rover has always been part of the Land Rover family, but it wasn't until like the mid to late 60s when Land Rover was seeing how great America was doing with what we now call SUVs, such as like the early Ford Broncos, the early Land Cruisers, and even some of the International Scouts. They were seeing that there was a need for not so much a pickup truck, but something that could haul stuff and carry more than just two people. And so a gentleman named Spencer King had this bright idea to add that type of utility slash luxury vehicle to the Land Rover family. And so around 67, they started to put together some sketches and, you know, some models. And by 1970, we were first introduced what we now know as the Range Rover Classic. You know, and for several generations of it, it was always a two-door because at that time it was still considered a working truck, but also a truck that could be taken into the city, back out to the country, you know, used for lots of different things, whether it be horse hauling or, you know, just general everyday farm stuff.
Now, let's remember that the first generation Range Rover was not what we think of the Range Rover today in terms of luxury and equipment. In fact, it had rubber mats. It didn't even have a carpet, which came later on. But the other unique factor was that it only had two doors. And I'm sure Dan will get into a little bit of the details, but a lot of people here in the U.S. market don't understand that the Range Rover originally had two doors, not the four that it has today. And so when some of us that own two-door Range Rovers, like Dan, for example, people on the street sometimes look at you and they think it's kind of funny looking. And the reason is because they're used to seeing a four-door, which was not the original, but the two-door, which was the original.
Yeah, it wasn't actually probably until 13 or 14 years later before four doors even was on the mind of Land Rover to add into their lineup. And a lot of people actually don't realize that the Americans had probably more to do with the success and the transition of the early Range Rover, the two-door, transitioning into what we now know as a luxury brand and a four-door brand. I don't think enough people give the American market the credit due to what actually turned around what was a suffering brand at the time and made it the most sought after luxury SUV, especially in the American market.
So, Dan, when did the Range Rover first appear on U.S. soil?
So the first Range Rover actually didn't make it in here until like 87. It was, they were futzing with like the 86 model, trying to adjust a lot of things so that the American market would buy it, you know, whether it be, you know, the a V8, four doors, just making it a little bit more luxurious and competing with what we already had, you know, in the market. We already had, you know, the Jeep Wagoneers. We already had SUVs that had leather, like had all like this luxury at the time. And so it really wasn't until 87 of March is when the first one actually landed. And it's actually really interesting what it took to like kind of get that brand here and rolling.
Now, I'll let you in on a little bit of information here. You could actually get Range Rovers before 1987. However,
well, it was a gray market, though,
it
right?
was a gray market yeah. car, exactly. And yeah. only through a few dealers in California. So if you really wanted one, you had to go out to California, order, and you knew that when you were ordering that car, you probably weren't going to have service for it because...
Oh, yeah, no way.
Nobody was going to know what to do with it.
No way.
And, of course, you had to deal with the whole private import process, which the dealer would do for you for a substantial fee. And, of course, you were stuck with something that nobody else had, and yet you didn't have the internet to know how to service it.
Right. And you still paid more than, you know, what you probably would have paid, obviously, if you were... you know, over in the UK and, you know, or Spain for that matter, you know, you're going to pay a premium for that, you know.
Fortunately, they were available in left-hand drive, so you didn't have to take one that was right-hand drive.
Right.
For the U.S. market. So that's the brief start of what the Range Rover was here for the U.S. market. Now, there's a few interesting things that we'll get to a little bit later on in this podcast, especially in regard to the promotional efforts that British Leyland, then owner of Range Rover, did in order to try to attract the American customer, which they later didn't do. But, you know, it kind of goes with everything. A lot of promotional dollars are lost in a lot of different things. Dan, a little bit more about going into a little bit more in depth. What's your favorite Range Rover?
I mean, I think it'll always be the early two doors, Range Rover Classic. There's just something about the two door. A, there's very, very few in the States. I tend to gravitate towards things that, you know, I'm not going to see everywhere. And, I'm a diesel guy at heart. And so the only way I'm really going to get something, you know, that no one else has that has a diesel engine is going to be a two-door version. You know, that's just what I've always wanted.
So going on a note about diesel, that's an interesting, point you bring up. Of course, for a lot of American people, the diesel engine didn't really make sense. First of all, because engines were smaller and less powerful. And second of all, because gas has always been cheap in the U.S., and while we don't see it as cheap, if you compare the prices of gas to other European countries, it's less than half.
Oh, 100%,
so
yeah.
Filling up your tank with, you know, getting 10, 11, 12, 13 miles to the gallon doesn't really make a difference to your pocket at the end of the month, and made even less back then.
Yeah.
Hence why diesels never really made it in the U.S., and this applied to the Range Rover market as well. Now, going back just a little bit, there are some interesting things about the engines on Range Rovers. As Dan Wall mentioned, I'm not 100% sure about this, but I believe it was 1985 or 86 that introduced the turbo diesel engine.
That is correct.
Right?
Yep, the turbo D.
Dan, Tell us a little bit about the different turbo diesel engines that Range Rovers have had.
Well, there's two variations that I'm familiar with, and that is the VM 2.4, which is their first version, which actually, if you've ever followed, Camel Trophy, the last Camel Trophy run that Range Rover ran was actually with the 2.4 VM, which, you know, sometimes gets kind of a bad rap, but I think mainly is because if you're not really familiar with something and you kind of get in your head that, like, you know, petrol's better than everything and, you know, what have you, and you don't really dig into the type of engines that you're running, they just, for some reason, will all automatically get a bad rap. But personally, I don't think Range Rover would have chose to run the 2.4 when they obviously were already running V8s at the time. There's a reason, you know, why they chose the VM 2.4, and it's because it's a damn good engine. Now, I run the 2.5 in my 90, and we were just discussing the other day that it actually is a way peppy, more peppier engine than, say, like a 200 or 300. So I really love the VMs as far as performance goes. And
now, Dan, you brought up an interesting point. Now, just a couple of differences. The 2.4 and the 2.5 actually had one substantial difference in that one had five and the other one had four cylinders.
Correct.
Now, you would think it would be backwards, but no, it was the 2.4 that had a four, that had a five cylinder, and it was the 2.5. However, the performance on the 2.5 in terms of torque and horsepower is better than the 2.4,
yeah,
just in numbers. But like Dan said, at the time when Land Rover decided they wanted to use a diesel engine in the Range Rover, they really didn't have their own engine developed. All that they had was the evolution of the 2.25 classic diesel engine that went in the series trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they went to VM, which was Venturi Motori, an Italian engine maker that also made, that was later sold on to Detroit Diesel. And I couldn't remember the date of that. But those Venturi Motori engines were used in lots of Chrysler products, Fiat, Alfa Romeo, and Toyota. So they were very, very good engines. However, and is in the case in a lot of engines of the time, if not well cared for, they tended to have issues. But that wouldn't be any different than any other issues. So Dan mentioned they do get a bad rep. But Dan, you've lived with them, so tell us.
Yeah, I mean, if you maintain it, you know, it's a tale as old as time. Like, if the engine doesn't take care of itself, I think a lot of people tend to have this, like, idea that, oh, it's a luxury car, it should last longer than, like, most cars. But in reality, is you still have to, like, change your fluids. You still have to, like, you know, give it its oils and do everything that one should do if you're going to take care of a car.
And not drive it like a race car. Well, it wasn't meant for that.
No, it's a work truck, you know. Can I go 65 on the Dan Ryan? Absolutely, and I have. It's like, you know, it's no big deal. Will it take me a few more seconds to get there? Sure. But, you know, I buy it because I love the classic, you know.
But it will also haul 3,500 kilograms, which is about 7,300 pounds.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing, too. There's a few turbo diesels are always an interesting topic. We'll get into that. After the 1990, it was actually 1992, Land Rover had come to the development of their own turbo diesel engine, which was the 200 TDI. And that engine was used across the line. Dan knows a lot about it because he also has one of those. So
yes, I have the 200 in my Discovery, which some of you may know, shares a lot of DNA with the Range Rover because it was kind of like the stepchild from the Range Rover. They used, you know, the chassis and the engine also in the Range Rover. You know, Land Rover was pretty smart in kind of crossing, I don't know how you would call it, but using a lot of the same parts and stuff between the two, but just only, you know, changing the body. But as I was saying, I run a 200 in my 93 Discovery, which also, by the way, has two doors. I love two doors for some reason. And the VM will beat the 200, you know, off the gate, you know, any day of the week. You know, there's just a lot more torque with the 200. I always say it just has a little bit more grunt. It's great off trails. You know, it's probably not, like, if you lived in the suburbs, it's probably not your best commuter truck, but, you know, we're not buying these classic Land Rovers for commuting, per se.
By the way, if you have the time to look up on YouTube, 1987 Camel Trophy Range Rover, you will get a good idea of what the Camel Trophy was about. I believe 87 was run in Malaysia, and I might be wrong about this. I can't remember the exact location, but there you can actually see a 2.4 five-cylinder VM engine put through its paces, and you'll see how well it does.
I mean, it really just shows it in its glory. I mean, that's what these trucks were designed for. You know, it wasn't until we got past, you know, the classics, you know, let's say we'll call like 94 the kind of like the new era of luxury. But up until then, I mean, they really just, you know, were trucks.
So after the 200 TDI, which was the first Land Rover diesel engine production, came the 300 TDI, which shares a same displacement, just a little bit different engine configuration, and gives you even a little bit more power, but not so much the longevity of the 200 TDI. 200 TDI is actually, performance aside, one of the longest lasting engines that Land Rover ever made. I think it was designed for that purpose, and it foregoed a little bit of the performance properties in order to give you, you know, a 200,000-300,000-mile engine with nothing more than your basic maintenance and cleaning out your injectors and your filters and all that. So that was probably, or is probably, the best turbo diesel engine,
and,
however.
And for me, I think it's, if you're just getting into, say, like the diesels, I always say, you know, start with the 200, just because anybody can do any of those maintenance things on those engines.
So let me recap a little bit. So I believe it was 1985, 86 that saw the Range Rover gain a turbo diesel, the 2.4 VM, as Dan mentioned. In 1990, the 2.4 was upgraded to 2.5, hence minus one cylinder. And 93 was the transition year into the 200 TDI, and 94, sometimes 93, the 300 TDI engine. And that's kind of the history with the Range Rover turbo diesel engines, all of which are more than capable, and it kind of comes down to the preference of each person, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, you know, you're going to have petrol heads that will just swear, you know, by V8s, you know.
And let's be honest here. I've owned, I think, 12 vehicles with VM engines. 12. And I think the one that had the least amount of miles was probably about 90,000, which was a Land Cruiser that I had that had the 2.5 liter VM engine. And honestly, aside from replacing some glow plugs, which was actually on your Range Rover,
yeah,
because when it came when it made the transatlantic voyage from Spain, when it came off the boat,
it was like, oh, I can't do this.
It didn't want to start.
Yeah.
The actual glow plugs had a total cost of $60 for the set of four. And if I had been a little bit more mechanically oriented, which I don't know if I am or not now, I probably could have done it.
I think you are now.
In less than about an hour,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nothing really big. They're on the side of the cylinder heads. They're easy to access. You just disconnect a few bolts, then you pull them out with gentle love and care, of course.
And that's you bring up a good point there, actually. When you like $60 for the glow plugs, you know, one of the wraps that any sort of like Range Rover will get, whether it's from the 70s or from 2 years ago, is parts are crazy, insane, expensive. And in reality, they really aren't. I mean, you know, with the age of the internet, you can pretty much, even OEM, you know, I'm talking OEM parts. I know a lot of people are like, well, yeah, you can get cheap aftermarket, but you can get, you know, well-priced OEM parts and for the most part can do, you know, the work yourselves.
They are surprisingly easy to work on for the most part.
And if you go overseas, I mean.
Well, yeah. Of course, that makes it a hell of a
lot easier. Nothing against our American distributors, but, you know, you might as well go to the source.
So why do you like a turbo diesel?
Mainly because, A, you don't see them, you know, and I just love diesel. I love the gas mileage. I love the grunt. I love, you know, everything that there is about, you know, diesels. My Mercedes are diesel. Like, there's just something about the sound of the engine. However,
you do have a couple of other Range Rovers.
I do.
Classics.
Yes. Yes. We'll talk about L322s at some point.
I don't think they use diesel.
No. No.
No. We'll talk
about why I like the L322 so much.
We'll get into that a little bit later. So, turbo diesels are definitely cool, and as Dan and I have mentioned here, there's a lot of talk about one engine versus another, and I guess it basically comes down to the use you want to give to it, and especially taking good care of it, and not trusting everything that you read on the internet about certain engines or not, because a lot of people have put down the V, and I want to take a moment right now with Dan right here, both of us experienced in VM engines, to make a case for the engine, because honestly, a lot of people here in the U.S., and Dan, I'm sure you've been through this, you've read it at some point, whether it's in one of our auctions on our Deer Bring a Trailer site,
right,
or whether it's on some website, will basically shit on the engine without knowing about it.
Well, how many people actually have owned driven one in the States? I mean, yes, if you're in Spain or like some of the other countries where you can have them and you've grown up with them and are familiar with them, then I'll listen to you. But for the most part, it's just always been hearsay. I don't know too many people who have had them for years, like myself, who drive them, who are intimate. We won't get into that, but with my Range Rover. So, yeah, it's just like the internet is. Everybody hears something, and then it spreads like wildfire. And
so remember, when you're considering a VM engine, you probably want to talk to somebody that's actually had one, experienced it, used it on a daily basis. That's probably going to give you a much better idea of what you're in for. And, of course, we're always available for any questions or any comments or anything like that that you want to ask us about the VM. I know several people call me regularly about some maintenance items, and, you know, it's really not that much different than any other engine. Anyway, we'll go back to turbo diesels later in the series, because we're going to have a specific episode, which is going to be gasoline versus diesel. And here I think Dan and I might be fighting a little.
Yeah,
bit.
It's going to be a throwdown.
Anyway, so back to a few interesting things about the history, and I just want to basically go back to a couple cool things about the Range Rover. Dan touched on something that was really interesting, which was that the Camel Trophy editions that were run on turbo diesels. The other thing was that a few Range Rovers in the 1980s, and 88 I know was a full year, ran the Paris-Dakar Rally, which was much more agricultural back then and actually went from the city of Paris, started off and finished out in the capital of Senegal, Dakar, which is a really fantastic, has some really fantastic and horrible driving sections. I've experienced a few of them myself, and I can say that it was probably the most fun I've had, but of course, my concept of fun might not be everybody else's. And yes, in a Land Rover, it was a disco, and it was a turbo diesel. And I'd like to remember if it was a 200 or a 300, but mostly I remember, and I was significantly younger than I am today, is that we took out the sunroofs and sat on the roof until it started getting a little bit bendy with two or three guys sitting on it. But it was all fun and games. Anyway, so the other thing is that Range Rovers have had a few cool additions that you might not know about, and one of the coolest ones, and this is what Dan was talking about, Charles Spencer King was the original, let's say, creator, designer of the Range Rover. And in 1990, a limited series of 200 CSK, Charles Spencer King, were made for the model year 1990, and I believe 1991 as well, some of them. Now, do you know about these, Dan?
Of course.
What was the color? What was the color?
Silver.
Beluga black. And silver as well.
And silver, yeah.
So the cool thing about those editions, aside from the, you know, different extras that they had and upgrades in terms of their materials that were used and walnut and carpet and better leather, is that that was the introduction of the 3.9-liter V8 engine.
It was.
Now, if we go back a little bit in time, now that we've touched a little bit on diesel, let's go back to gas. So the original Range Rovers had 3.5s, right, Dan?
Yep.
And these were quite problematic because of the fact that they had a couple of Stromberg carburetors that worked
when they wanted to.
Every once in a while. Yeah. Once in a blue moon.
Yep.
But it's actually funny because I'm of the opinion, and you might agree with me on this, it's kind of like a lot of people like will go back on these and say, oh, they're horrible, but then you ask the people at the time, they weren't that bad.
They weren't, and to this day, I still think they're the most beautiful setup in a V8. I think that they're just beautiful.
And needless to say, that was paired to a 4-speed manual transmission, which is what you had to drive.
Yep.
So if you wanted an early Range Rover up until the mid-80s, you needed to learn to drive a stick.
Yep, you had to drive a manual. But in Europe, though, I mean, that was – everybody drove manual.
Nobody drove automatics. No. Automatics were considered extreme luxury cars if you had an automatic. So that's a cool CSK edition. What I like about it was what it was introduced, and it kind of rendered some type of homage to CSK, Charles Spencer King. And the other interesting year for Range Rover in my eyes is 1981, because 1981 brought us the In Vogue edition.
Now, do you know how that all came about?
I know you're going to tell me about that because I don't.
Yes. So some people may know this, but back then, British Vogue, the magazine, was actually quite genius on the part of Land Rover at the time. Vogue magazine is actually responsible for that name coming to Land Rover. They were using Range Rovers in all of their photo shoots in the background as kind of self-promotion luxury. And at the time, no automotive company had trademarked that name in the auto industry, and Land Rover took the name, trademarked it, and used it. And actually, it was probably one of their best-selling series that they ever created, was the ones that were badged Vogue.
So the other thing that you might need to know is that you might be thinking, shit, I've never seen a Vogue edition Range Rover in the U.S. as a U.S. market car. And you're right, because it wasn't called a Vogue edition for the U.S. market. Here it was called a County. Now, that probably has to do, and Dan might know a little bit more about this, because Vogue was probably trademarked in for the U.S. market.
It was, yeah.
So they couldn't use that. So whenever you see a Vogue edition of a Range Rover, you're probably right in thinking it's the upper level trim, and it was probably for a European or foreign market. And here we got the County, which was a name that could be used to classify the trim of the Range Rovers.
The great thing about the Vogue trim that I like absolutely loved was the bold striping of the words Range Rover on the bottom of the doors. And I thought at that time it was like, that's pretty bold. I really liked that kind of trim package that they put on those early Vogues.
Dan, do you remember your first encounter with the Range Rover?
Well, it's kind of blurred because, you know, growing up, in my house, we watched a lot of PBS. And so I grew up on British television. And so, you know, they always used Range Rovers in like The Prisoner and like a lot of shows. And so for me, and now I've rewatched like so much British television. I think it's just always been in my subconscious of just, you know, from being a kid, you know, 12, 13, just seeing this type of, you know, SUV, it just has always been there.
So I'll tell you mine. When I was a kid, my uncle and my aunt lived in the Canary Islands, which are Spanish islands off the coast of Morocco.
Yep.
And at the time, the Canary Islands had and they still do, a special taxation regimen, if we could call it in some way. And the idea behind that is that every citizen of Spain should have, you know, the same quality of life. And if you had to pay extra taxes for everything that was shipped out there, you know, general basics, then it was always obviously going to be very expensive to live in the Canary Islands. And this applied to a lot of the taxation on cars and gas. Therefore, you found the Canary Islands got a lot of these bigger engine cars and trucks that mainland Spain didn't get. And I spent my summers, I was fortunate to spend my summers in the Canary Islands with my family. And my uncle had two Range Rovers.
Wow.
One was, and I'd love to know.
Like, do you remember what year this was?
So this must have been, well, I my first recollection of them would have been probably 87.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I kind of remember them. And
so what would they have been, two-door versions at that time?
They were actually four-door versions,
four-door.
Both of them.
Oh, okay.
Of course, all of our family went to the Canary Islands and stayed at my uncle's house. So at a certain point, there were probably about 30 of us there between, you know, adults and kids.
Yeah.
And we needed some transport. And I remember that one of them was brown, and I'd love to know the year so I could track down the exact color. I'll try to have that for the next episode.
I've been so obsessed with brown ones lately. Like,
they're
amazing. Yeah. Go ahead.
And the other one was green. And so we used to call them the chocolate car and the mint car.
Oh.
So every time we'd have to leave the house, it would be a fight to see who got into the chocolate car or the mint car. Of course, I love them both. And I actually have a couple of pictures of the car.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
Which is really cool. And hopefully by that, I'll be able to track down the year and track down the color. But that was my first experience. And I'll share a little secret. The first Range Rover I owned is now owned by Dan.
Oh, that would be the 1990 Alpine White VM engine. I love it.
Two-door. With cloth trim interior. And even, well, think about this. When I sold it to Dan, And he asked me, does it have air conditioning? I said, no, and it does.
Yeah, and it does.
Does it work? Have we ever tried
it? No, I don't. I'm not an – I have tried it, but I'm kind of old school in the sense that, like, if I'm driving a truck or something that has a little bit of utility to it, I almost want to sweat. Like, there's just something about a truck where I don't need that, like, convenience. Like, I get that at my house. I get that at work. Like, I get that everywhere else. I kind of want to be one with the truck, and so I don't prefer air conditioning.
I understand that. Fortunately, also, the Range Rover, and I highly recommend that if you haven't had the opportunity to drive a classic Range Rover, to please do so. The driving position is outstanding. The windows are huge.
And no blind spots.
No blind spots. And the two-door versions have sliding rear windows, apart from the normal front passenger windows that you can open, and of course the four-door. I'll let you in on a little. I want to get back to one more thing about the Range Rover body styles, but there's something I think Dan is going to share with you. It's about the differences between two-door and four-door in terms of length.
Well, there is no difference in length. They're both the same length. Of course, if we're, you know, there's a difference between the short wheelbase and the long wheelbase, but your mind will tell you otherwise when you're looking, you know, at a two-door versus the four-door, but in reality it's the same.
So when Land Rover decided that they were going to make a four-door version of the original two doors we've mentioned here, they did not do anything to the car. They basically shortened the driver's door, enough space to stick in a second door behind it, and they didn't touch anything else. So what you'll find from a two-door to a four-door is that the rear seat is in exactly the same spot as the front seat. The only thing is that in the tour, the front seat goes forward, obviously. So people,
I mean, you have to remember that Land Rover really never made money. So they were always thinking about ways to use other bits and pieces, how to cut costs. And the genius of it is we still paid ungodly amount of money for these vehicles.
Yes, we did. So that's just a little bit for those of you that aren't familiar. The original, as Dan mentioned, was a two-door. Then we got the four-door, and then we got the four-door long wheelbase, which was mainly meant for the U.S. market. The only difference is that you've got about, what is it, Dan, like 6 to 8 inches difference?
Eight, yeah.
In the back, so that if you're a basketball player and you need to sit in the back, your legs fit a lot more comfortably.
Yeah, and that, you know, that wasn't introduced until 93, actually, was the first time you'll see a long wheelbase.
Well, long wheelbase models are also cool, but I just wanted to, I wanted us to mention the fact that the two-door and the four-door are exactly the same length.
Yep.
So the other thing, you know, there was something that's kind of cool here that we haven't talked about, and it's that Dan covered a lot of the fact that in the late 60s and early 70s. By the way, if anybody wants to take a look at some really cool special edition Range Rovers, the Dunsfold collection in southern England is fantastic. They've got a lot of, well, they basically have very special Land Rovers of all kinds. They have a cool 6x4 rapid intervention vehicle, which was bodied by Carmichael, and a lot of other cool stuff. Their website's not that good.
No, it's pretty antiquated, but they pretty much have every edition from the Pope Range Rover to, like,
ooh, the Pope Mobile.
Yeah, they basically have every Range Rover.
So we're focusing a lot here on classic Range Rovers, and that's kind of what we wanted to do in this one. I'm sure we'll find some space for later Range Rovers, for the P38, the L322.
Don't get me started on the P38.
No, we're gonna have to beef that one out. It's cool. I know it has problems. We all do. Anyway, the other cool thing that I wanted to end with is, and I think this is really cool, is that Land Rover, as the British, in the nature of who they are as people, always did expeditions. And that was their big thing. And that's how they colonized part of the world by one means or another. But they developed trade routes and all that. Well, we could go into that British shit. But anyway, in late 1969 when they had developed the Range Rover, and as Dan mentioned, they wanted to sell it to the U.S. market, they decided, how could we promote this? And someone came up with the Range Rover Transamerica's Expedition, which was basically an expedition designed to show the capabilities of the Range Rover. So what they did is they grabbed a couple of Range Rovers and they took them to the northern port of Alaska. And then the idea was, within a few months, drive them all the way down to Cape Horn. And that sounds, and not very modified. So they wanted to keep everything to factory possible modifications or upgrades that you could actually get on the cars if you wanted to buy them. So there were very few upgrades that were made. But the big issue here is that they also wanted to be the first, or one of the first, not the actual first, to cross the Darien Gap. Dan, do you know about the Darien Gap?
I do.
Tell us a little bit about the Darien Gap.
Well, it's amazing to think that Land Rover even thought that they could get anything that they built, and not to diss them, but to think that they could actually get something through this and accomplish this major feat that they had set out to do.
Well, the Darien Gap is about 250 miles long, located between Panama and Colombia, and it's basically one big shit show of a swamp. And for many years, there have been many expeditions that have tried to cross it by motor vehicle of some sort. In fact, there's actually a guy and his wife did it on a motorcycle, and I don't think they were assisted. No. Who knows?
Well, that's even a little easier than four wheels.
Anyway.
Knowing what you have to get through.
Anyway, it really was. It was a cool thing that they were thinking about it. And the idea was that they would be able to show the capabilities to the especially the North American, but also Central and South American markets. It took them about 6 months to get from tip of Alaska all the way down to Cape Horn. They spent 96 days to cross the Darien Gap, and they had to fly back several times to England to get more parts, more gas. So they really didn't do it on their own, Dan.
No.
But with more assistance than you would think, they actually made it through. If you look on a few different websites out there, you can take a look and find some period documentaries about this, which is kind of like a really cool thing that they decided to do. Now, I found something really funny when I was researching this a little bit, and I want to end with this, which was that they had some special swamp developed tires, and these were bigger and were I can't remember who made that. It was probably Michelin I don't want to put on a brand that they didn't, but they had some special swamp developed tires. And the only problem is they hadn't tested them. So they were swamp tires, but they'd never really been in a swamp.
Right.
So very much to the British.
Now, do you remember if they snorkeled?
They did.
They did.
Did snorkel. That's a good point. They also had to cut out part of the body to fit the swamp tires, cut out the wheel arches.
The arch, yeah.
And about, I think it was 1 month into the Darien Gap part of the expedition, which they'd probably maybe gone 2 or 3 miles at the most, they decided that the swamp tires weren't the right ones.
They weren't.
And they had to fly in. Yeah. Had to fly in some original all-terrain tires that the car would have originally sported.
Yeah.
And apparently that kind of helped a lot. And the other cool thing is that at the end of the expedition, they needed a support vehicle. And what do you think they picked up?
Tell me.
A Series 3 Land Rover.
I own a Series 3.
And guess what? It was a lot better than the Range Rover at that terrain. Hence, a lot less comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
But they made it through. Anyway, Kind of cool to look that up. If you have some time, look it up. It's the Range Rover Transamerica's Expedition. There's some cool footage of video. There's also some cool footage of video of the Range Rover Dakar, as Dan mentioned, the Camel Trophy, and a lot of different expeditions that have been done by Range Rovers.
Thank God for YouTube. I mean, you can just get lost watching
it. What would we do without?
I know.
What would we do without?
I know.
So, Dan, I'm gonna let you say goodbye and finalize this episode with some whatever thought you have about the Range Rover. I know your thing with Range Rovers is a love affair, and hopefully nobody hears us.
I mean, that's just basically what it is. It's whether you like Range Rovers or you're a Toyota guy. It's either you get it or you don't. And I've always had it. I always will. I love the Marquis. I love basically all of their vehicles that they do, except for maybe one. but I love all things Land Rover. And as we go through this series, it's going to be my pleasure to share all my thoughts on these.
Dan, thank you so much for sharing this.
Of course.
Have episode 2 in the pipeline called, and it's titled Owning a Land Rover, which is going to be interesting. So there will be a bit of Range Rover, a bit of Discovery,
a bit of series, a bit of L322.
We might even go into Velar. Ooh, I don't know. And Dan's non-favorite P38. So
yes.
We'll see you in, well, we won't see you, but hopefully you'll listen to us for episode 2. Hope your day is going well.
All right. Thanks, guys.